This is the Archaeology News Weekly, and I'm David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now, the main headlines from around the world are as follows. Stone Age art caves may have been halls of sound. The Ring of Brodgar in Scotland is to be re-excavated. And the exploding asteroid theory in North America around 12,900 BC is strengthened by new evidence. And we also have evidence that humans wore shoes 40,000 years ago. A Neolithic house is found during an excavation in England, and Stonehenge, £37 million later, and back to square one. 4,500-year-old mummies are discovered in Chile, and new finds are made at Rotherwas in England, even as the new road over the fabled Rotherwas Ribbon is completed. And finally, Stonehenge builders rival Pythagoras in their geometrical mobility. Anyway, straight to the news. Prehistoric people chose places of natural resonant sound to draw their famed cave art. That's according to new analysis of Paleolithic caves in France. In at least 10 locations, drawings of horses, bison and mammoth seem to match locations that focus, amplify and transform the sounds of human voices and musical instruments. Igor Reznikov, an acoustics expert at the University of Paris who conducted the research, points to the cave of Neo in Ariège, where most of the remarkable paintings are situated in the resonant Salon Noir, which sounds very much like a Romanesque chapel. An intriguing possibility, but one that Reznikov admits is hard to test, is that the acoustic properties of the cave partly influence what animals were painted on its walls. For example, horses are related to spaces that sound in a certain way. Reznikov first noticed the strategic placement of cave art while visiting Le Portel, a Paleolithic cave in France, in 1983. An expert in the acoustics of 11th and 12th century European churches, Reznikov often hums to himself while entering a room for the first time so that he can feel the sounds. He was surprised to discover that in some of the rooms in Le Portel, decorated with painted animals, his humming became noticeably louder and clearer. Immediately the idea came to him, would there be some sort of relationship between the location of the paintings and the quality of the resonance in these locations? Since that moment, Reznikov has found correlations between painting locations and the resonance of their surroundings in more than 10 Paleolithic caves across France, with illustrations ranging from 25,000 to 15,000 years old. Paul Pettit, a Paleolithic rock art expert at the University of Sheffield in the UK, who was not involved in the study itself, said that Reznikov's theory could explain the puzzling distribution of paintings at many cave sites. As in a number of decorated caves, the images cluster in certain areas, with areas of perfectly paintable walls being often ignored. Pettit added that Reznikov's research is consistent with other work that suggests that music and dance played an integral role in the lives of ancient people. Instruments such as bone flutes and roarers, bone and ivory instruments that whir rhythmically when spun, have been found also in these decorated caves. Work will start next week to unearth the secrets of one of Europe's most important prehistoric sites, the Ring of Brodgar in Orkney in Scotland, the third largest stone circle in the British Isles, and thought to date back to around 3000 to 2000 BCE, is regarded by archaeologists as an outstanding example of Neolithic construction. It's also become a very popular tourist attraction to the islands. It's believed it was part of a massive ritual complex, but little is known about the monument, including its exact age and purpose. It's hoped part of the mystery will be explained during a month-long programme of investigations by a 15-strong team of archaeologists and scientists from Orkney College, Stirling and Manchester Universities, as well as the Scottish Universities Environment Reactor Centre. The project will involve the re-excavation and extension of trenches dug in 1973. Geophysical surveys will also be undertaken to investigate the location of standing stones and other features within the Henge monument itself. A scheduled ancient monument and a property in the care of the Scottish Government through Search Scotland, the stone circle is also part of the Heart of Neolithic Orkney World Heritage Site, inscribed by UNESCO in 1999. The last important archaeological studies undertaken on it were in the early 1970s by Professor Lord Colin Renfrew. Dr. Jane Downes of Orkney College's Archaeology Department, one of the project directors, said that the interpretation of what is arguably the most spectacular stone circle in Scotland is incomplete and unclear. The advanced techniques now at their disposal means that this is the time that investigations can establish when the Ring of Brodgar was built and perhaps enable us to learn a great deal more about it. Good luck there with that project. Geological evidence found in Ohio and Indiana in the USA in the recent weeks is strengthening the case to attribute what happened 12,900 years ago in North America, when the end of the last ice age unexpectedly turned into a phase of extinction for both animals and humans, to a cataclysmic comet or asteroid explosion over the top of Canada. A comet-asteroid theory advanced by Arizona-based geophysicist Alan West says that an object from space exploded just above the Earth's surface at that time, sparking a massive shockwave and heat-generating event that sent large parts of the Northern Hemisphere ablaze. Now University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Anthropology Ken Tankersley, working in conjunction with Alan West and Indiana Geological Society research scientist Nelson Schaefer, have verified evidence from sites in Ohio and Indiana that offers the strongest support yet for the exploding comet or asteroid theory. Samples of diamonds, gold and silver that have been found in the region have been conclusively sourced through X-ray diffractometry back to the Diamond Fields region of Canada. The only plausible scenario available now for explaining their presence this far south is a cataclysmic explosive event such as that described by West's theory. Tankersley was familiar through years of work in this area with the diamonds, gold and silver deposits, which at one point could be found in such abundance in the region that the Hopewell Indians who lived there about 2,000 years ago engaged in trade in these items. Additional sourcing material is being done at the site looking for iridium, micrometeorites and nanodiamonds that bear the markers of the Diamond Field region, which also should have been blasted by the impact into this region. The timing attached to the comet asteroid theory of about 12,900 years ago is consistent with the known disappearance in North America of the mammoth population and also the first distinct human society to inhabit the continent, known as the Clovis civilization. At that time, climatic history suggests the Ice Age should have been drawing to a close, but a rapid change known as the Younger Dryas event instead ushered in another 1,300 years of glacial conditions. A fascinating and terrifying prospect for us all there, that in the blink of an eye, everything can change. Humans were wearing shoes at least 10,000 years earlier than previously thought, according to a new study. The evidence comes from a 40,000-year-old human fossil with delicate toe bones indicative of habitual shoe wearing. A previous study of anatomical changes in toe bone structure had dated the use of shoes to around 30,000 years. Now the dainty-toed fossil from China suggests that at least some humans were sporting protective footwear 10,000 years further back, during a time when both modern humans and Neanderthals occupied portions of Europe and Asia. Study author Eric Trinkhaus, a paleoanthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, said the scarcity of toe-boned fossils makes it harder to determine when habitual shoe-wearing became widespread. However, he noted, even Neanderthals may have been strapping on sandals. In a previous study, Trinkhaus found that shoe-wearing and barefoot human groups show characteristic differences in the size and strength of their middle toe bones, Consistent shoe use results in more delicate toe bone structure because footwear reduces the force on middle toes during walking. In his latest study, this anatomical evidence allowed Trinkhouse to date the origin of shoes to a period long before the oldest known shoe remains. Well, I'd wonder, did Neanderthals wear socks and sandals? Perhaps that's why they became extinct. Anyway, archaeologists have found that site of what they believe is one of England's oldest permanent houses, thought to be more than 5,000 years old, at Kingsmead Quarry in Horton, close to Windsor Castle. Dr. Alistair Barclay of Wessex Archaeology said it was a rare discovery, with only about a dozen Neolithic houses discovered in England, and the Horton House was one of the most complete examples ever found. Dr. Barclay said that this house is not big by today's standards, but it was a dramatic difference from the tents that people had been living in previously. Archaeologists believe the walls of the 10-metre by 5-metre building were made of split logs, and the pitched roof consisted of reeds or grass. The find is thought to date from about the 4th century BCE. It did not have a chimney, and smoke seeped through the roof, which was high enough to avoid catching fire from the sparks of the fire. Other Neolithic finds near to Horton include a burial site and a ritual processional way known as a cursus that stretched for over 4 kilometres. And now the latest on, yes, Stonehenge. A major public consultation is set to take place in a new bid to upgrade disgraceful visitor facilities, appalling traffic conditions, and the poor environment at Stonehenge after the dramatic collapse, metaphorically speaking, of the tunnel and visitor centre schemes. The initiative by Heritage Chiefs will focus on road improvements to the increasingly congested A303 and where to build an interim visitor centre. Thousands of responses from organisations ranging from heritage and archaeological bodies to residents groups are expected after the exercise is launched next month. The Back to Square One move follows the waste of £37 million of taxpayers' money on failed attempts to solve traffic and heritage problems at Stonehenge. After 8 years of planning and controversy, the entire Stonehenge A303 improvement scheme was axed late last year. Earlier this year, Culture Minister Margaret Hodge pledged to do everything possible to upgrade clogged roads and disgraceful visitor conditions at Stonehenge before the 2012 Olympic Games. She's now asked English Heritage to take the lead on reviewing the World Heritage Site Management Plan and also to form an environmental improvements project. English Heritage will work with partners to look at what improvements can be made in terms of visitor facilities, road and traffic management in the wake of the A303 debacle. It proposes to launch a 3-month consultation for a revised Stonehenge World Heritage Site Management Plan at Amesbury on July the 15th. Why do I have the feeling that I'm going to die an old man and they still will not have solved this problem? My question has to be, surely anyone who actually needs to be asked has already been asked over the past 8 years, and should more money be handed over to look into what improvements can be made in terms of visitor facilities, road and traffic management, when that very question has already been looked at? Just my £37 million worth there. 8 perfectly preserved mummies believed to be some 4,500 years old were found by workers engaged in a restoration project in Chile's far north. These mummies date back to between 2000 BCE and 5000 BCE, said archaeologist Calogero Santoro. The mummies are individuals belonging to the Chinchorro culture, which was one of the first to practice mummification, and the perfect condition in which these mummies were found is indicative of their advanced techniques. 3 of the 8 skeletons have been kept on the site in Morro de Arica site for visitors to see them, while the other 5 have been taken to Tarapacá University in northern Chile, where other mummies found in previous years are preserved. The area of Morro de Arica is known for its mummies. Several hundred of them, some as old as 7,000 years, were discovered in 1983. In 2005, the University of Tarapacá found 50 Chinchorro mummies, dating back to 4000 BCE during the demolition of a house. The unusually large number of mummies found in this sector indicate that one of the oldest Chinchorro cemeteries must have been located there. The Chinchorros are presumed to have died out or migrated from this region in the 1st century CE. The remains of animals burnt at extreme temperatures have been confirmed amongst finds from the Rotherwas Ribbon, the 4,000-year-old archaeological site uncovered by road building work near Hereford in England last year. An initial assessment report prepared for Herefordshire Council suggests that the ribbon was some sort of ceremonial site and one of many that early man etched into the surrounding landscape. Recently, archaeologists working on the southern fringes of Rotherwas found a fire-cracked stone surface similar to the ribbon and links to the burnt material like flint and pottery. Specialist post-excavation assessments of the ribbon saw that the badly weathered bones of cattle, pigs, dogs, cows and probably sheep showed evidence of burning at more than 800 degrees Celsius. A human finger bone was also found. Radiocarbon tests are now underway to define the ribbon's exact date. Flint tools found at the site include finely flaked scrapers for woodworking and meat preparation, as well as strikelites to produce sparks against iron pyrites. The latter struck the assessors as particularly unusual, as such strikelites were usually kept among personal items and not casually discarded. Of the 143 pieces of flint found, many also showed evidence of burning and breakage, again unusual compared to similar flint assemblages found in the area. Unfortunately, Hereford Council succeeded in building a road over the site despite the protests of campaigners. The road was officially opened to traffic on June the 30th this very year. Maybe English Heritage could have saved the ribbon by scheduling it, but it's expected that the scheduling decision will be slightly late, especially seeing as the road is now already built. In the meantime, another archaeological discovery has been uncovered close to the site, a platform of burnt stones thought to date back to the same period as the Rotherwas Ribbon. The platform is much smaller in scale than the ribbon itself, but is constructed of similarly burnt stones and is of apparent prehistoric date. Andy Boucher, Managing Director of Archaeological Investigations Limited, which is carrying out the work, said that there is a clear similarity in the use of fire-cracked stones in the formation of this platform compared to the ribbon discovered last year, so it seems unlikely that they were separated by any great span of time. It's exciting because the new discovery is associated with features containing a wealth of evidence about the past environment and may well help unlock our understanding of the ribbon. Stone Age Britons had a sophisticated knowledge of geometry to rival Pythagoras, 2,000 years before the Greek father of numbers was born. This is according to a new study on Stonehenge. 5 years of detailed research carried out by the Oxford University landscape archaeologist Anthony Johnson claims that Stonehenge was designed and built using advanced geometry. The discovery also suggests it is more rooted in the study of geometry than early astronomy, as it is often speculated. Mrs. Durr Johnson believes the geometrical knowledge eventually used to plan, prefabricate and erect Stonehenge was learnt empirically hundreds of years earlier through the construction of simpler monuments. He also argues that this knowledge was regarded as a form of arcane wisdom or magic that conferred a privileged status on an elite who possessed it, and it also featured on gold artifacts found in prehistoric graves. The most complex geometrical achievement at Stonehenge is an 87-metre diameter circle of chalk-cut pits, which mark the points of a 56-sided polygon, created immediately within the monument's perimeter earthworks. Mr. Johnson used computer analysis and experimental archaeology to demonstrate that this outer polygon was laid out using square and circle geometry. He believes that the surveyors started by using a rope to create a circle, then laid out the four corners of a square on its circumference before laying out similar second square, thus creating an inner octagon. The points of the octagon were then utilized as anchors for a surveyor's rope, which was used to draw arcs which intersected the circumference so as to progressively create the sides of a vast polygon. I hope you stayed with me there. I was just wondering if we can maybe get hold of this new technology and help English Heritage to reroute the A303. Again, just another thought. Well, believe it or not, next week we are going to be having the 100th edition of the podcast news. Yes, it's been 99 so far. So if you have any ideas of what you'd like to hear on the 100th edition, please do get in touch. And again, coincidentally, next week we'll see the launch of the third issue of the Past Horizons magazine. If you haven't seen them yet, pop along to www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. Yes, it's a free online magazine, well worth looking at. So that's www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. And can I remind you that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the usual heritage calendar, library guidance section, and interactive forum, can be found at Badger, www.bajr.org. And more can always be found at the fabulous Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks very much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return to us again next week for the fabulous centenary issue.